This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, there's a lot of buzz in Washington over the looming start of open enrollment for the insurance exchanges. October 1st is the first day, but it's also the start of the new fiscal year for the federal government.
Well, the countdown has begun on both counts, and some Republicans in Congress are making good on threats to find a way to defund Obamacare by holding up approval of the federal budget.
And there are targeted efforts underway in a number of states to find ways to block funding of the health care law. But in spite of this lingering opposition, the law is moving forward. California has tested their computer system that will handle the influx of new insurance customers and have given the signal that all systems are go.
Well, that's great news because there's such uncharted waters for a lot of states. Mark, states that in particular had to update antiquated systems so that departments that oversee Medicaid can communicate with revenue service departments. It's to be expected there'll be some growing pains as these systems get off the ground. And this is definitely a case where the people who upgraded early have an advantage.
They certainly do. And speaking of Medicaid, there will be an expanded eligibility for Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act, including folks with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty line. But an interesting study was done on who will be taking advantage of the Medicaid expansion.
Well, that's right, Mark. And the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has done such a great job in this area, did a study and found that those taking advantage of expanded Medicaid are likely to be younger white males. And that's a group that's generally healthier than the typical Medicaid recipient.
Very interesting. And the study also showed that the average age of Medicaid recipients is going to drop by 3 years from 39 years to 36 years of age.
Well, another interesting aspect of this young adult population is that they're definitely more comfortable consuming products online and shopping online and interacting via mobile devices. So as we see this generation going into the health insurance exchanges, it may feel more natural to them and may also help propel the advance of mobile health and telemedicine protocols, something our guest today is very familiar with.
Dr. Joseph Smith is with the West Health Institute, which is dedicated to improving health outcomes and bringing down health costs by promoting the growth of mobile health technologies.
The Institute is studying the ways that mobile health, telehealth, and genomics are poised to really transform healthcare in the United States and across the world.
And we'll hear from Laurie Robertson, who checks in from factcheck.org to set the record straight about myths and misstatements about the healthcare law.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Joseph Smith in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. House Republicans are moving ahead with efforts to find a way, if only symbolically, to defund the health care law. House Republicans have tried 40 times unsuccessfully with separate measures to defund Obamacare. This latest measure would tie approval of stopgap funding of the federal government to a measure that would defund the health care law, forcing the Democratic-controlled Senate to actually vote on the measure. A recent poll showed only 6% of those surveyed felt the health care law should be defunded and that holding up funding of the federal government in the new fiscal year would have negative consequences for the GOP. Meanwhile, the House is considering another way to impinge on the rollout of the law that is allowing tax subsidies to those who seek insurance on the exchanges. The House is slated to take up legislation this week that targets the health care law's subsidies that will help individuals buy coverage through the insurance exchanges. The measure, sponsored by Tennessee Republican Diane Black, would bar the administration from providing the subsidies until the Health and Human Services Secretary confirms the system is in place to verify applicants' household incomes and health insurance status. Meanwhile, corporations are shifting some pieces on their benefits chessboard in response to the healthcare law and its changes. IBM has announced it's dumping its retiree health benefits onto the exchanges. Not the Obamacare exchanges, but a Medicare exchange. Medicare-eligible retirees will no longer be eligible for IBM's company health plan. Instead, they'll get a subsidy to buy supplementary Medicare coverage. This is the continuation of a trend. Time Warner has announced a similar move recently, as has General Electric last year. This has less to do with Obamacare. Instead, it's more about cost control. Know someone who's trying to quit smoking? You might have a new motivating weapon. Graphic television commercials showing real smokers dealing with the devastating effects of long-term exposure to the habit. It's part of the federal government's Tips from Former Smokers ad campaign, in which graphic images of smokers who'd suffered from throat or other cancers, inserting false teeth, placing speaker boxes in their tracheotomy hole, talking about why you should quit. A study showed that of the nation's 45 million smokers, 1.6 million tried to quit after seeing the ad, and 13% were successful in staying smoke-free. Historically, about half the nation's 45 million smokers try to quit every year, and yet cessation rates still only hover around 5% annually. Public health officials have long been telling smokers cigarettes shave years off your life, contributing to more than 400,000 deaths a year. Electronic cigarettes are sparking lots of skepticism from public health types, worried they may be a gateway to regular smoking. But the cigarettes, which use water vapor to deliver nicotine to the lungs, may be as good as the patch when it comes to stop smoking aids, a study finds. Smokers who used e-cigarettes in an attempt to quit the old-fashioned kind of cigarettes did about as well at stopping smoking as those who tried the patch. And smoking kills a lot of folks, sure, but stroke and heart attack are still king in the killing department. A report from the Centers for Disease Control shows about one quarter of those deaths could be prevented with better intervention and primary care through better management of blood pressure and cholesterol and other contributing factors. The study found that deaths by heart attack and stroke actually declined after age 65 when patients were able to access more regular care. And the pre-Medicare population with decent health insurance also had better outcomes. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joseph Smith, Chief Medical and Science Officer at West Health, which includes the West Health Institute and the West Health Policy Center, nonprofit entities founded by philanthropist Gary and Mary West, dedicated to advancing technology in healthcare that will lead to lower cost and better health outcomes. Dr. Smith is the former Vice President in Emerging Technologies for Johnson & Johnson and also served as Chief Medical Officer for Boston Scientific. He was named by Health Leaders magazine as one of the 20 people who make healthcare better. Dr. Smith, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we always seem to be at some critical juncture in healthcare in America, and certainly over the recent years, the cost for healthcare has skyrocketed. It accounts for about 18% of our gross domestic product, and people say it's been growing at an unstable rate. And yet, we have the passage of the Affordable Care Act, created a lot of new opportunities, not only for including more Americans in the healthcare system, but also for generating discussions about the need to contain cost. You've recently quoted Rahm Emanuel saying, "Never let a good crisis go to waste." But many great minds have been trying to sort out this crisis of skyrocketing cost in healthcare. Share with us and our listeners your goal at West Health of lowering healthcare costs, but also improving patient outcomes.
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about how we always seem to be at a critical juncture in healthcare. I'm not sure that we've always faced the challenges that we currently face. I was reading a report a little while ago that says that if things continue as they are by 2030, the median family income will equal the median family expense on healthcare, including insurance and out-of-pocket expenses. And I don't think we're actually going to head there. I think we know that we need to be in a different spot. And I think all of the national focus on healthcare reform, I think, is timely. It's essential. It's probably overdue. I would point out that much of the Accountable Care Act is reform about how healthcare is paid for, and not so much about how healthcare is delivered. And that's really where we think there needs to be a much sharper focus. And I think there is an opportunity to decentralize, perhaps democratize, and in the process maybe even demystify some of healthcare delivery. We see four different areas for impact that draw a lot of attention for us. The first is in efforts to create more of an efficient medical marketplace. You would not think of going into a restaurant and having the maitre d' decide what you should have for dinner and then send you the bill 3 months later. And yet that's the way healthcare gets apportioned, delivered, and paid for. And so we need to take advantage of all of the natural skills we have in assessing value in the things we need and we purchase and apply those to healthcare.
So, Dr. Smith, you are trained as and practiced as a cardiologist, but you also have an extensive medical engineering background. You said that we're at this fertile intersection between engineering and medicine. Tell us more about that. What are the collaborations at this intersection that you're tracking out at West Health?
I love this space. I've spent my whole career at this, what I think is a wonderful intersection between engineers who are inherently problem solvers and healthcare, which is really not short at all of problems. And so I think there's a tremendous opportunity to make a difference. You know, it's with some humor that I read in a recent Congressional Budget Office report that medical technology is widely viewed as being in some way responsible for escalation in costs. Technology itself, when appropriately applied, has dramatic opportunity to lower healthcare costs. We're working under the rubric at the moment that chronic diseases ought to be managed episodically at encounters in doctor's offices or emergency rooms or hospitals, as opposed to when a patient needs to be seen. And I think we can completely change that paradigm of chronic disease management. I mean, you know, when you have complex equipment, you don't wait for it to start making a funny noise in order to service it. We have dashboards on our cars that tell us how things are going so that we can make those interval changes to keep it functioning well. We have all of that for technology that we care about, and yet we don't do that for chronic disease management where we really could. And so the notion of using little bits of technology to look in on patients who aren't in front of a doctor, who are in their normal activities of daily living or who are sleeping, and look in using relatively simple bits of technology to get a dashboard on how is that person doing. So that patient with heart failure, if they've gained a couple pounds, and if when they walk up a flight of steps, it's a little bit slower for them. All of that's information that's readily accessible, and if we just bothered to look at it and use, you know, smart systems that we have in place for other complex machinery, we'd be able to identify those people who are beginning to fail, as opposed to waiting for them to get so sick.
Well, let's pull the thread a little on that and talk about mobile technology. And with billions of people possessing cell phones in the world, you say we're just not utilizing this platform for delivering better healthcare in a meaningful way yet. You say that we need to move our healthcare system from moving the patients to moving the data to serve the patients when and where they are needed. So how do we achieve the ends when we have a relatively siloed healthcare system at present?
So siloed is perhaps an understatement, and I do think that speaks immediately to the need here. I think we have an inherent problem, which I think we have lots of systems that each manage data different ways and store and transmit and query and answer differently. And so this notion that if you're a Mac user, as I am, the notion that every time you get another piece of Mac hardware, the other hardware works with it just fine. It knows exactly where it is and what it can do. And it was all easy. It was all functionally interoperable immediately. And we have none of that benefit in healthcare. We have every different vendor making information flow using their own proprietary formats and processes, in part because we have this desire to make sure that healthcare information is both secure and timely. But I think one of the downsides is that we've created every different company that makes one of these gadgets has its own way of moving information around, and that frustrates the notion of the value proposition of the plurality of these solutions, so that we no longer depend on each device alone to manage all of the concerns around a patient, but we can use a smarter net of devices that can all talk to each other to get a better, more holistic view of how an individual patient is doing or populations of patients are doing. We have it in terms of an internet backbone. You know, you don't need to buy a specific computer or a specific cell phone to get on the internet. We have an internet protocol that allows every device you can imagine gets on and accesses the internet and shares information. We do not have that for wireless medical devices or electronic medical records. It's all been siloed up and diced up and with lots of little proprietary walled gardens that are really getting in our way at this point.
One of the things, Dr. Smith, in clinical facilities specifically seems to be this whole issue, as you pointed out there, about the wireless revolution that has come. And clinical facilities are challenged to provide a system that's both secure and it's high functioning. And you've noted that there's these three elements impacting broadband use in the clinical setting. You've got the patient monitoring system, obviously critical. Two, you have the technology that handles the business and the data side. And three, you've got that Wi-Fi user walking in the door every day. So how do you envision these three tiers being effectively managed, either in the healthcare facilities of today or the clinical facilities that we're trying to build for the future?
Well, I think the good news is people are readily admitting that there's an issue and a concern here. You would like not at all to have the young grandson of a patient downloading a video in the waiting room and have him use up the critical bandwidth that's necessary for monitoring his granddad
exactly.
In an intensive care unit, right? So,
right.
You know, on one hand, you'd say, well, I'm sure that doesn't happen. But if, in fact, we're all using a shared resource without some notion of prioritization, that can, of course, occur. occur. You can have the least vital but perhaps most consumptive processes taking over all of the space. And so one of the fellows working with us here used to be president of Inner Wireless, a private company before, but now is working with us in a nonprofit setting. He's architected what we call medical grade wireless utility, and it's a solution for that issue that manages the appropriate resource distribution in hospitals. And it's something that we've architected and make freely available for hospitals. And Ed's now worked with, he tells me, I think almost 100 hospitals in trying to get them up to speed. And so there is this notion that wireless communication can be as dependable and reliable as power and oxygen and lighting in a hospital.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joseph Smith, Chief Medical and Science Officer at West Health, which includes the West Health Institute in San Diego and the West Health Policy Center in D.C., nonprofit entities dedicated to advancing technology in healthcare that will lead to lower costs and better health outcomes. Dr. Smith is a fellow at the American College of Cardiology, as well as the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering. Dr. Smith, you mentioned just a few minutes ago liberating health data. I was thinking about our good friend Todd Park, who's now the Chief Technology Officer. And tell us a little more about what the bigger picture is of how you're going to liberate data and how that's going to help us build this efficient, effective, and elegant healthcare system with just-in-time delivery of health information when you need it.
Well, it's a tall order, and I think almost anyone's enthusiasm would pale next to Todd Park.
We agree.
I've watched him talk, and he gets up in a lather, and I think it's because there is this remarkable opportunity. When you look at what the good Mr. Park has opened to him in terms of data that Medicare and Medicaid has collected over processes and procedures they've paid for and then outcomes they can track, I think there's an opportunity to ask all sorts of questions, particularly when you introduce new technologies and you can determine how they're used, but then whether or not the outcome is in fact represented in a larger cohort in a real world scenario. And so I think we have one of our fellows working closely with Todd to see if there's an opportunity to enhance the clarity and the transparency associated with large data sets and see where there may be the greatest possible opportunity to make a difference.
Dr. Smith, your colleague at West Health that we referenced a little while ago, Dr. Eric Topol, spoke about the need for training the next generation of healthcare providers. That's a subject near and dear to our hearts in primary care, and to train them to understand these emerging areas of genomics and telemedicine and other innovations in care that are contributing to the transformation of healthcare. Tell us about how you at West Health are approaching innovation in health professional training in your fellowships, and how might these fellowships and the training that you're doing disrupt the traditional model of health professions education?
We've talked about how fertile this intersection is between technology and medicine, and it does require, you know, energized individuals. We're lucky to have a couple of these present with us at Scripps Wireless Health Scholars. This is the notion of taking folks who are, you know, already trained physicians, many board certified, exposing them to the engineers and the kind of the technology that may be amenable to use in clinical scenarios where people really haven't explored the full opportunity. And then we also have a fellowship with UCSD here as well. As energized as they are, they're still too few. So we're trying to set an example of how to do this. And one of them, you know, came up with a really cool idea, and we've been able to provide enough resources that here in the near term, that's likely going to be its own little startup company because the idea looks like it could really make a big difference. And so we love this opportunity. It is, again, this fascinating collision between energetic people and a tremendous need, an unmet need to make healthcare much more affordable. And so San Diego is a terrific environment for that because unlike the East Coast, where I did all my training, where the model is one more of excellence through local competition, here there's more of a model of excellence through collaboration. And so, of course, it takes smart people in the middle. And so we're delighted to have these fellows take advantage of the opportunity.
Well, you not only have smart people, but you have a sweet organizational design at West Health. And you have two not-for-profit branches, and you also have two for-profit branches, the West Health Investment Fund and the West Health Incubator. We're always, it seems, at the garage phase of innovation around healthcare. And it looks like you've got a nice collaboration that goes on to support the activities that go on. Tell us about some of the promising investments investments that you've made, as well as other innovations that are underway at West Health?
The structure that we've adopted with the four organizations is not accidental. If you come up with a good idea, or if you see other people with them, how do you then go the next step? And so part of that is small business incubation. You know, when if you think about an innovative and entrepreneurial community, it's really everywhere. And so how do you accelerate the work of others? And that got us to starting an investment fund. And then ultimately, it doesn't really matter if you come up with a great solution if the public policy environment or the incentives for payment aren't aligned so that they can be appropriately used. And so that got us to be quite active in Washington, D.C. at a policy center. To spend a moment on the investments, all of the investment proceeds go back to the charitable mission. And so this is, you know, and all four of these organizations share the same vision and mission, which is how to lower healthcare costs in the United States. Along the big data theme, we have a small investment in Humedica. It's a Boston-based company that's looking really hard to make sure that when you look at big data collected from multiple hospital systems, you're not going to get kind of waylaid by casual descriptions of patients, and they do natural language processing of doctor's notes to better understand that when someone gets coded as having diabetes, do they really have diabetes? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if they're exposed to a particular therapy, are they really taking it? So we like them for the big data play. In terms of healthcare transparency, particularly transparency around pricing, we like a small company that we invested in called Change Healthcare. And they're working with large employers to make sure that when their employed population needs to make a healthcare decision, that they understand the price and as best they can the value. And then when we think about this notion of taking care of people with chronic diseases when they're not in the hospital, we've invested in a small Minnesota company called HealthSense. And they work very hard to look at these kind of continuing care models of retirement communities where you'll have a spectrum of different forms of living scenarios on one campus to instrument the apartments in the people's homes so that it's easy to look in on them either from the vantage point of the organization or even from their family to make sure that, you know, mom's up out of bed, she's taking her medicine and everything's pretty much okay or not. And that gives you a way to prioritize who you need to check in on a given day. And so this notion of, you know, less intrusive but appropriate at-distance monitoring to make sure that people are doing okay with their chronic diseases, we like that as an opportunity going forward.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Joseph Smith, the Chief Medical and Science Officer at West Health, whose unique mission is to advance innovative and cost-effective technology innovations and solutions that will lower the cost of healthcare in America. You can find out more about the work they do by going to westhealth.org and follow them at West Health. Dr. Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
And thank you today. It's been a real pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, over the years, we've debunked the claim that Congress was exempt from the Affordable Care Act. It wasn't true in 2010 when the law was being debated, and it's not true now either. Congress isn't exempt from the law's requirement to have insurance or pay a penalty if you don't. In fact, the law places an additional and unusual requirement on members of Congress and their staffs. It says that members and staffers must get their insurance through the exchanges created by the law starting in 2014. They can't get insurance like they do now, or like other federal employees, through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. This provision was added by a Republican amendment with the idea that if the exchanges were good enough for other Americans, they should be good enough for Congress. There's a problem, though. The provision doesn't say anything about the federal government being able to continue to contribute to premiums of staffers and lawmakers, just as many employers do for their workers. In August, the Office of Personnel Management, which administers the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, issued a proposed rule saying that the government would be able to continue to make those premium contributions, and the contributions couldn't be greater than what the government provides under the Health Benefits Program for other federal employees. That prompted new claims of Congress being exempt from the law or getting a special subsidy. But this supposed special subsidy is simply the premium contribution that Congress's employer, the federal government, has long made to the health plans of its employees. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Mariano O'Hare with this tech report. Imagine an ultrasound wave so small, so precise, it can target a single cell within the body through the skin, penetrating that cell with laser-like precision. That's what electrical engineer Professor Jay Guo has concocted in his lab at the University of Michigan. A specialist in nanofluidics and nanobiotechnology, Dr. Guo has figured out a way to coat a lens with nanoparticles that help convert a laser light beam into a highly precise sound wave that is roughly the width of a human hair, a so-called invisible knife.
It's almost like an invisible knife. It doesn't cut through the tissue, but it does the therapeutic function inside the body.
That's Dr. Guo speaking with us via Skype from Shanghai. So how does the laser beam create this ultrasound knife? Well, Dr. Guo created a lens, kind of like a contact lens, and coated it with special nanoparticles that transfer that laser beam from light to sound.
So light incident onto this lens, now absorbed by the carbon nanotube, and then that turns into heat, and this heat is transferred to this rubber layer that produced the ultrasound.
The whole idea of developing ultrasound beams with high precision started with the idea that ultrasound waves are more harmless to adjacent tissue and don't harm flesh around a targeted area.
Because the precision now is much higher, so when you do these type of surgery, you could possibly avoid nerves, you know, it only targets the region that need to be treated.
While he says he's not a doctor and more research needs to be done, there are any number of applications the invisible knife could be used for that would provide a painless, precise way to target some pesky enemies like kidney stones, cancer, and more.
The most effective treatment one is when the tumor is very tiny. And then also treating the tumor, you don't want to affect the nearby healthy tissues.
You can find out more about the work coming out of Dr. Guo's lab by Googling the Guo Research Lab, that's G-U-O, at the University of Michigan. His work was recently profiled in the publication Scientific Reports. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Sitting down, it seems, can be as potentially deadly as smoking if done for long periods of time and over a long period of time, and that's not good news because we are a nation of sedentary sitters. And it turns out sitting is a big contributor to our obesity epidemic, to the rise in diabetes and heart disease, and a host of other illnesses. So when Steve Bordley was injured in an accident a few years ago, the active former elite athlete ended up sitting in a wheelchair for almost 2 years, and during that time, he gained a lot of weight. And when he had to learn to walk again, this former distance runner began to see the health benefits of just walking, not intensely, but consistently throughout the day. Now, the Surgeon General recommends 10,000 steps a day to maintain good health.
10,000 steps a day is kind of the benchmark that the Surgeon General has set for the minimal amount of steps that an American should take. And the University of Tennessee about 2 years ago did a study and found that the average American walks less than half of that amount. So we're actually deteriorating if we're walking less than that.
And when he was able to go back to work, he worried he was going to slide back into the pitfalls of sitting. His solution? He created the Trek Desk. Bordley designed a modular standing desk that fits over any exercise machine. The idea being, if you just walk slowly but consistently, the effects would be tremendous.
I was literally walking 10 hours a day, very slowly, and within a period of about 6 weeks, I lost more than 25 pounds. My back problems went away, and I was sleeping like I did when I was in my 20s. I felt tremendous.
And some research to date bears him out. Walking slowly throughout the day does seem to do remarkable things for your health. reduce your chances of getting type 2 diabetes, reduce the risk of certain cancers, and maybe even reduce the incidence of first heart attacks. And it runs about $500, maybe 10% of the cost of some high-end models for exercising out there. And it can be assembled in under an hour.
People should at least move throughout the day. Whatever they can do to move is critical to their health. And that's really the message that we're trying to get out. 10,000 steps at a minimum. Everybody should know the amount of steps they're taking during the day.
The Trek Desk, a simple reconfiguration of the typical workspace, but one that allows for purposeful movement throughout the day, improving health and well-being and cognitive skills. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.